Adventure Hotel Mars, David Livingston, Dr. Space, The Space Show, and we're very pleased to be speaking with Daniel Suarez, a novelist of science that for now is taking what we have here on Earth in hardware and software and projecting them into Earth orbit, cislunar orbit, the solar system for prosperity. Prosperity, of course, brings competition. We've talked about the hardware, the spin gravity station, the SPS Alpha Mark III solar power satellite, mining of regolith, the software. We have the Outer Space Treaty, which is a product of the Cold War, 1967. We have the Moon Treaty, and now we have the Artemis Accords. None of these, to my knowledge, exactly fit the circumstances that Daniel is very convincingly presenting. Private enterprise in competition with state enterprise, that would be the authoritarian regimes that have science and engineering to match ours, and the contest on the moon, in lunar orbit, and especially in the proximity of an asteroid. Daniel, I'll go right to the heart of it. Who owns that asteroid?
That's a fair question. Now, if you take the Outer Space Treaty, no entity can own a celestial object. You know, at least that's the legal statement, proclamation that we have thus far. So if you go back to the nation of Luxembourg, and I believe it was 2017, they put out a space law saying that you, while you may not be able to own celestial objects, you can mine them and process that those resources to potentially bring it back to Earth. Although I think the real main thrust of that there was that you could bring the value of it back to Earth to sell and trade. Now, perhaps leaving the resources themselves in space, thus creating an off-world market. The United States followed suit very shortly thereafter, and then it started to build into the Artemis Accords, which I think is an effort to try to build a modern version of the Outer Space Treaty. The Moon Treaty exists, but there are not many signatories to it. And I think what's going to happen when it comes to both the Artemis Accords and the Outer Space Treaty is they are going to stretch to the point where they must absolutely change, because we have different entrants. This is a really pressing issue, space, right now. We see competition between authoritarian nations and free nations of the world. I think this Cold War in space that is essentially building, because, of course, there's a Cold War building here on Earth. And so it's, I'd say, similar in some ways to the original Cold War, except that technology has advanced rapidly. And I think it's going to be the expansion into space is going to be much larger this time. And I do think the competition is going to be quite sharp. And that's why I really wanted to underline first mover advantage here. I mean, we have the Lagrange points. I think those are going to be key. The nation states or the commercial enterprises which first establish operations at these Lagrange points, I don't think it's going to be a matter of control. I think it's going to be a matter of the first organizations that build there will help establish standards. And those standards, let's put it this way, if you want to go do things in space and there is already a space station that has tens of thousands of square meters of commercial space available, pressurized volume, it's got food, it's got spin gravity, people can rent space there. That's where people are going to go. They're not going to want to necessarily launch everything themselves. David, rival nation states may want to, but I don't think commercial enterprises will.
David, you have a question.
I'm curious, as all of this continues to move forward, we already have opposition to commercializing space, and we haven't even started the thousands of launches that you talk about will be needed.
Yeah.
But people are pushing forward. The entrepreneurs are going forward. They're already living out your book in one way, even though it's many, many years before your book takes place. Do you think that the entrepreneurs, the people doing this, the pushback, the money, will keep pushing to the point where the Outer Space Treaty, the resistance, and Artemis are going to crumble? And is that the scenario that you see? Or will these treaties and the multilateral agreement anchor down to hold some order and maybe slow down or maybe change the way discovery and all of the exploration and the development takes place?
I would say that the Outer Space Treaty is not going to so much crumble as it is going to evolve. And I think it is going to evolve very quickly. The issue with thousands and thousands of launches from Earth, again, I think is that is a permitting issue. That's going to be more and more difficult. I guess we see some shades of this with Starship now, but the nation states of the world, whether or not they permit these launches, that's going to be a bottleneck. And that's what, one of the reasons why I think ISRU, that is, again, in-situ resource utilization, is going to be so compelling. And the first entrants into commercial mining who can build their own spacecraft and other components in space, in orbit, in cislunar orbit, will have a tremendous advantage because then they don't have to launch out of Earth's gravity well. And again, they don't have to request permission to continue. I think one of the phrases that I've always liked was proceed until apprehended. I think that's going to be a mantra for many of these organizations. And that doesn't necessarily mean a negative thing. That doesn't mean they're going to try to oppose others. I think the scale of the opportunities in space, the opportunities for growth, the opportunities also for cooperation across borders, people working together, perhaps sharing in a common enterprise to build some very useful infrastructure in cislunar orbit, you know, that could bring us together, sort of the overview effect. I do think that bottleneck of heavy launch off of Earth, I think that's one of the things many of these companies are going to try to get around by, whether it's having a mass driver on the moon or obtaining refined resources from near-Earth asteroids. All of that, I think, is going to be in preference versus launching continually from Earth, because I think that's really where you get Earth authorities having much more influence on the pace of operations, the tempo of operations.
Daniel, we're on the eve of heavy launch. That would be the Long March 9 booster that the People's Republic of China is building. That would be SpaceX's Starship and Super Heavy. That would be whatever Blue Origin creates, and there are other opportunities for other companies looking. That heavy launch is upon us right now. What are your hopes?
My hopes for Starship is that it becomes a very useful heavy lift workhorse. I don't see it primarily as useful for colonizing Mars. And people who've read my books know that I don't think colonizing Mars is the proximate thing we should be doing next. I think we have urgent work to do in building an off-world industrial infrastructure in cislunar space. Starship could be tremendously useful in bringing up the initial components for that, 100 tons at a time, tremendously useful.
30 seconds, Daniel. Go ahead.
But I do think ISRU, in-situ resource utilization, is going to be the key. And to the extent that Starship can get that started, that's helpful. And Long March, I guess, is the competition. There you've got a sovereign state that won't care about profits, won't care about any permitting, and they will try to keep pace.
Yes. Whiskey's for drinking, and the South Pole of the Moon's for fighting. Dennis Suarez, the author of the Critical Mass novel, number 2 in a trilogy, about the near science of space prosperity. David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show, Hotel Mars. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.